This is, of course, a Temple Honors podcast where we learn about honors professors and their upcoming courses. I probably need a better tagline than that, but it's pretty accurate. This is Brad. I'm the Assistant Director of Honors. And today we're talking about a course in the fall called Journalism 3900, Media Memory and Social Change with Professor Carolyn Kitch. Who is remembered? What is remembered? How they are remembered? And the role media and we all play in determining those things. We have more power than ever to determine what is remembered and how it is. We just need a little creativity and access to technology that, as of only a generation or so ago, would have been considered mind-blowing. So it's a course tailor-made for social media savants or Luddites, social activists, budding or otherwise, and really any student who realizes that history and memory are active processes. And knowing how to play a role in creating history and memory is a vital life skill. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Professor Kitch on her course, Media, Memory, and Social Change. I worked with Ruth today. I don't know how we got on this tangent, but we started talking about celebrities being memorialized.
Yes.
She just kind of got this like look in her eyes like, oh, I have this Princess Diana tea. And so that's what she wanted me to show this to you.
But does she know that I collect Diana stuff?
I don't think she knows that. Do you really?
Oh my God.
Now, do you have this one?
No, I don't.
In case this makes it on the podcast, it's an extra large t-shirt, Diana memorial that actually Ruth said that a former student who's now a professor here, Jeffrey Bowles, brought back for her when he was in London in 97, shortly after her death.
Oh, wow.
And so.
Yeah, I was there with a group of students in our summer program in fall program in 2017. Mm. And it was August, and it was the 20th anniversary.
Okay.
And we were walking through Kensington Gardens. Yeah. And, you know, we said, what are all these flowers doing here?
Mm.
They were all, I mean, huge, huge, huge flowers and crowds. It was for the 20th anniversary.
Yes.
And people had left stuff on the
fence. My goodness.
And I had to try to explain it. One of the things that we're going to do in this class is sort of take seriously the phenomenon of, you know, what happens when famous people die. Because they're always remembered in terms of us,
mm-hmm.
people who we feel that we do actually sort of know.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because we have a connection with them at any given time, but also over time.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long-term relationship.
Yeah, they might as well be family to some people,
yes,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's highly mediated.
And Princess Di is a great example of that, right?
Yeah.
People felt like she was more intimately involved with them than obviously she was.
Obviously.
Yeah.
She was a royal.
We did not
in fact know her.
Exactly.
Personally, but mm-hmm. yeah. And of course, you know, what people were reacting to was, I think, a sense of this grand story of the princess story in which the princess is mistreated. You know, this imaginative story of how people deserve to be treated and the difference between, you know, ordinary people in public and people who are in power. And so there were lots of sort of moral aspects, emotional aspects to that story, and I think that's true in the life remembrances of lots of different kinds of celebrities.
Hearing you talk about it, you know, I do wonder if part of it, and maybe the class will cover this, is this idea that people just seek meaning in so many ways that when they can't find it in their own life.
Yes.
Or because they're in their own life every day, it's hard mm-hmm. to kind of see the forest for the trees. But with a celebrity that has these kind of, like you said, grand gestures, mm-hmm. Almost like an archetypal figure,
right.
They can see the meaning and it just resonates and connects with them more. So maybe that's why they feel the connection, because it is more of like, a childhood story or a childhood hero that mm-hmm. That just means something because it is so, for lack of a better term, simple and easy to tell right and wrong, black and white.
Right. And that is, to a great extent, what the theory behind memory studies comes from sociology, from social psychology, to some extent from historians. This is now a subject that's of interest across all kinds of disciplines. Mm-hmm. But the main theoretical idea, which sounds incredibly simple, is that we remember through recognition through stories, through recognizing stories, and that what we remember are things that we have been able to process in story form, in narrative form, and we forget a lot of stuff if it doesn't make sense in the story, or if the story is not one that we recognize as having heard before. And so there are, as you say, archetypes and certain kinds of characters, even though they're real people, we recognize what they stand for because we have seen those stories and those characters make sense in a certain way in our own social circles, our own lives, our own families, our jobs, and in media.
So that makes sense that we think about celebrities in terms of their narratives and what they represented within those narratives. But I want to turn to another aspect of the course, which is social movements and how we think and remember them. Does that same process of memory making through recognition and really especially repeated recognition, does that work in how we think about and remember social movements as well?
Yes. So for instance, if, the civil rights movement, for the past 15 years, there's been this cycle of media commemorative products, on-the-ground reenactment, film, fictional film, musical tributes to the civil rights movement, but quite specifically to certain episodes and certain people. The Voting Rights March of 1965 is a really good example. In 2015, which was the 50th anniversary, this story was told in so many different formats. Within a one-year period, one of them was the film Selma, which was a fictional film. I mean, those were actors reenacting but retelling the story of King's life in sort of a new way, showing him as a more flawed person. And the song from that film, John Legend and Common actually going to the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, and standing there and performing the song on the bridge. On the anniversary itself, Barack Obama stood on the bridge and made a huge speech with the surviving people, including John Lewis. John Lewis had written a graphic novel called March about this. There were postage stamps based on iconic photographs of the young men, you know, with the word vote across the man with his forehead and carrying the American flag. So all of these images were in circulation at the same time. It would, and so this educates young people in history they wouldn't have known about, but it also makes it far more likely that that particular moment of the civil rights movement is still going to be in public memory 50 years from now. And there are other aspects of the movement, chiefly the fact that the movement was continuous, right? It wasn't just the March on Washington, 1963, great moment. 1965, the Voting Rights March, great moment. There were ordinary people steadily doing regular things in local communities that get forgotten. And what is remembered are the great moments. There is a new museum in Mississippi, the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum, and they have overtly, and Mississippi is a place where many especially awful events, very bad, not that there's ever good murder, but you know, I mean, the very bad, highly publicized murders happened. And they want to, they're overt in their interpretation, saying we want to change this story because Mississippi has been remembered as this terrible place where there were sort of punctuation points of awful moments of violence. And that's true, but they're also, you know, 20 or 30 years of ordinary people, especially women, organizing and gradually gaining support for the cause, gaining voting rights. And so they tell a more constructive local story that's been forgotten in the bigger picture.
So is part of the, and part of your scholarly research as well as maybe part of the focus of the class, identifying why something is remembered and why something is forgotten?
And that's a key question of memory studies. And the difference between, I should say that the difference between history and memory, first of all, history is continuous and we are in it right now. Mm-hmm. But also we will be talking about actual things that happened in the actual past. Mm. The memory aspect of it is, in fact, the question you've just asked, which is what gets remembered and what gets forgotten. And so, you know, what departs from common public knowledge? What is lost of history, the real things that happened in the past? And then what stories do we retell? Mm. And how do we retell them in different ways that usually are connected with whatever is going on now? So to go back to the example of the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. many of the iconic photos and in some cases songs have come up again, have been reused in the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, in the last 5 or 6 years, as these anniversaries have been going on, those are planned events. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a for a long time, it was known that there would be a 50th anniversary reenactment of the March on Washington, and Barack Obama was president. He gave a big speech. What was less predictable was the fact that the Black Lives Matter movement was going on at the time, 2013, so 50 years from 1963. And the Trayvon Martin story was part of that remembrance and made it a slightly different story, made it very hard to say, you know, we have overcome.
Yeah.
And look, we have an African-American president, so we must be in a post-racial era.
Right.
And so the present day uses and the presence of current events in that historical ceremony made it alive and made it impossible to say this story is over.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's very, very relevant right now.
Mm-hmm.
There was an example of this also, there's a museum in Washington called the Newseum, the Museum of News, and they have had a series of civil rights exhibits for the past 6 years. And the last one is still there now. It's still open now, and it's about the year 1968. So last year was 50 years from 1968. And it's really all about the assassination of Reverend King.
Mm.
But they also have small displays of other things that happened in 1968, largely related to race. I mean, lots of 1968 was a huge year on the world stage.
Yeah.
But when I visited it twice and I saw the same thing both times, which is that everybody who was in that space, and it's a small space, was looking at only one thing, partly because it was a moving image. It was a film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a film that had been made for that exhibit. And what it was a reference to, the 1968 event it was a reference to, was the Black Power salute that was given by the Olympic athletes, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, at the Mexico City Olympics in 1968, which in its own time was considered as in contrast to Martin Luther King. You know, that this is a radical expression of power, and King was a peaceful expression to power. So now, 50 years later, they're part of the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And what the film was about was Colin Kaepernick and Michael Bennett and the kneeling controversy. And they had interviewed John Carlos and Tommy Smith for this, or John Carlos at any rate. And he said, this is us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not different. This is a continuation of what we were trying to do and the statement that we were trying to make. So connecting then and now in a way that really transforms who is in the continuous narrative of what 1968 was about.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was looking at only that.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow.
Yeah.
It was a very powerful example of how current events bring the past alive in unexpected ways.
Do you think that present-day social movements are only as valuable or as worthwhile as how well they can connect to the past? Is that a vital component of kind of gathering people, gathering them around a common cause, is to find that legitimacy from the past to kind of march with?
Mm-hmm. As an excellent question, and it's an interesting question, because on one hand, part of the power of social movements is a collective conviction that something is incredibly important in a new way right now.
Okay.
And therefore, we must do something about it. So that sense of urgency and newness is, I think, a necessary aspect of a social movement moving forward. However, there are, I think you could argue that some of the most effective movements are ones that have strategically used the past to either de-radicalize the present, meaning to say we're not crazy after all, this happened before, there is a longer story to this, and we are not just, you know, brand new unhappy people, this issue has come up before, or to re-radicalize the past. So in the case of Martin Luther King Jr., he's been sort of re-radicalized, because over time he was de-radicalized. And so he now has been re-understood as, in fact, someone who was about to be, had he lived, he would have been a global leader of the peace movement, because he was being, at the time he died, he was being very critical of our involvement in Vietnam. And then there's also sort of the issue of the institutionalization of memory. This June is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And so there are already events and exhibits planned in New York and in Washington, at least, that are place-based. You know, they're in the Village in New York. But there is now a new national park site that, in fact, was opened under President Obama. And so if the National Park Service is running the Stonewall National Monument, which is what it's called, that sort of, in a way, it both mainstreams, de-radicalizes, and re-radicalizes all at the same time.
That's interesting. Yeah, it legitimizes it. But the fact that it is under national purview radicalizes it, saying it's still an issue that warrants attention.
Exactly.
Interesting.
And yet, that is in living memory. And the people who were involved in it, many of them are still alive.
Right.
And it's a profoundly visceral, physical, local New York City experience. So one of the things that we also will talk about is the relationship between place and not individual experience, but specific experience, and then sort of what gets claimed as as being in the national story, and how, you know, national media or non-place-based media make connections with particular stories that once belonged to particular people. You know, when does the story of your social group, your action, your particular moment in history become woven into a much broader story that's not about you anymore? And we can see that to an extent with the women's rights movement. It's interesting that it is happening to the GLBTQ history in America, and I think people have mixed feelings about the mainstreaming of activism for problems that are not yet solved.
Is it because they think that the activism has to remain an undercurrent, a subversive element to actually affect change?
Yes, and it has to be understood as an urgent problem. And to say, well, that problem is, we're now celebrating an anniversary, which is a sign that that problem is behind us, is almost never true.
Interesting.
And very often it is on anniversaries when the problematic aspects resurface.
Once you start getting the fundraising dinners that are $5,000 a plate at the Hilton, then you start to lose the connection to the initial cause, it sounds like.
Another thing that I'm hoping that we're going to do in the class is think about the relationship between new media technologies and people's desire to sort of make pilgrimages to particular places. And this is an example of a history that no one alive can remember. And therefore, we can sort of do what we want to with that story in mediation. We that just on November 11th of last year was the end of a four-year period, of a centenary period of the First World War.
Okay, yeah.
And there were tributes to the soldiers, the British soldiers who fought the First World War, that were planned online, that were planned through social media, that involved live streaming these events throughout the days that they happened, on certain anniversary days.
Of like battles or?
No, other, okay. but like the very last day, November 11th, the centenary of the armistice, and this had been planned for months. It's a director named Danny Boyle. He did
Trainspotting.
Yes. Yeah. And he planned this tribute, which involved people going to beaches, sand on ocean, right, all over the United Kingdom, using photographs that came from the Imperial War Museum, so old photographs of particular soldiers who had left from those beaches. And they etched their faces into the sand.
Wow.
And then they watched the tide come in.
Yeah.
And sort of wash the faces away. This was live streamed all over the world. I sat in Pennsylvania and watched it live on the day that was happening. There were musical performances and people. And the idea was that it was a local person and it was people in those towns who came out to do this. And it was just this extraordinary example of, you know, what does mediation mean, especially when you're trying to pay tribute or tell a story about history in some new creative way that nevertheless involves real people who feel real investment in saying this part of the past matters. And I think that that's a, to me, that is one of the most fascinating direction of memory studies, is the connection between the arts and imagination and very, very factual documentary aspects of history, and that come alive in often some very inspiring and moving ways, and sometimes in some very funny ways.
I think what strikes me about that is the idea of new media and the democratization of technology in general giving power to people that normally wouldn't have power to tell that story.
Exactly.
So in that example of the World War One, the local artist or the local, whoever has the connection to the person that they're sketching, right?
Yep.
You know, maybe that person only has a photo of the person that they keep in a shoebox, and that's the only memory that ever is made. But now all of a sudden, that shoebox image is on a world stage.
Yes.
And it wouldn't have been possible with just mass media or past, you know, forms of media that maybe wasn't so democratized.
Right. And you've just said this very well. I mean, the power to tell a story is a power indeed. And that is a lot of, that's why, I think is one reason why people feel so invested in the memorial process when there is an act of terrorism, when there is a school shooting, when there's something that, you know, is happened to people we don't know. And yet I think there is a very genuine sense of obligation.
Maybe part of the effective nature of a student taking this course is thinking about the role that they can take, telling a story that hasn't been told, or being a part of a movement wherein before they didn't feel like they had a more of an active role. And it's thinking about the different, like you said, creative ways to do that.
Yes.
Is that hopefully one of your goals if I'm going down this road?
It's absolutely one of the goals. And it plays out in just the process of learning and talking about how certain parts of history, certain people in history ought to be remembered, is something that we can do and should do as human beings now among us. And then the bigger question of how do you create something,
right?
Whether it is a work of art, whether it is a journalistic story, whether it's a documentary, how do you, whether it's a song, how do you do something that then communicates that story to other people? Because that is an act of communication, that it is in the present but carries the past.
Bring it back to media a little bit. I do wonder also if, because you can basically blow up a story in things like streaming platforms, you're not confined to just, you know, I wasn't alive in the 70s, but I imagine TV in the 70s was much more limited in scope and what you could do. Movies as well. But now you can watch a 17 and a half hour documentary by Ken Burns on the Vietnam War and feel that it is more inclusive of different voices.
Yes. Or
podcasts even too.
Yes. Although there's a flip side of that phenomenon. And it is one question that memory studies scholars are asking somewhat preemptively, which is that, I do remember the 70s. And yes, the choices were much more limited, and so all of us watch the same things. I mean, that's an exaggeration.
Of course.
You have massive audiences with relatively few choices. Therefore, there is much more common media memory among those generations.
Mm-hmm.
I am more likely, and someone else my age is more likely to have encountered a particular television show or a particular film. And so one of the questions is, well, what if in our post-scarcity media world,
our sprawl,
are there going to be common memories? And if so, how will they continue? Who will select them?
Yeah,
and how will they then sort of be built into narratives that are in fact repeated to more and more and more people, so they can become common memories?
Mm-hmm.
This is a big question now for people who study, for instance, photography.
Right.
The idea that we all recognize that there are certain iconic images. Well, the question is, going into the future, will that phenomenon continue?
Mm-hmm.
If there is this multiplicity of images
done
at all sorts of levels, but images created by people who were experiencing the event, how does this change what we presumably have as a shared body of knowledge about the past? It's a fascinating question.
Interesting. Because as soon as you started answering that, I was thinking, well, what are the iconic images? I mean, just recently I think of Charlottesville. Like, there was iconic imagery from that still. But more of what I think about is the vast options in that day of to see different perspectives, the different videos that were on social media, the different like quick updates on CNN. So it's almost like, yes, the iconic photography is still there, but it's slowly being either, equal timed with the array and multiplicity of voice. And what you're saying is potentially that multiplicity of voice will replace the shared common or the iconic image.
Yes, and it may be that we will agree on iconic events, or we'll agree on what were important events that trigger a memory in us, and it triggers a memory of that event in other people.
Yeah.
But collectively, we have different memories.
Right.
It's of the same event. It's of the same moment of recognizing that this event mattered.
Mm-hmm.
That this event said something much bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And that share, whether it's a generational agreement or a regional agreement among people saying, yes, that person, that moment, that event matters, but our understanding of it is varied.
And then I think, to put the rose-colored glasses on, with that, we hope that then the next step is the conversation is such that where people can share their different interpretations and use those different interpretations to build the story back, basically, rather than building kind of deductively.
Mm-hmm.
They're building it inductively. Now, that's the rose-colored glasses.
That is the rose-colored glasses.
I hope dialogue is still civil enough, right?
Well, because the other option is you have your history and I have my history.
Right.
And history is equal because it's just our opinions.
Facts are just opinions, yeah.
But also that history is that people do have different pasts, and we already have seen how those notions of heritage and inheritance can create a sense of division and can be used to maintain divisions.
Mm.
Sometimes they are senses of the past that we thought had sort of faded away.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happens and they flare up again.
Mm-hmm.
That old images, old folklore, old, figures from the past suddenly gain new life because they stand for some new way to divide ourselves rather than to help us to see each other better.
It's that same story we were telling at the beginning about shared repeated images, but maybe the dark side of the coin, saying
yes.
You can take that and actually kind of revitalize them for ill intent.
Right. And I think it's important for us to remember that very often both of those things are happening at once. And depending on sort of where we are, sometimes literally geographically where we are, but also, you know, sort of where we are in our lives and in our heads, we're not aware that there's always the potential for, you know, there's always the likelihood that the past is being used, even the same past is being used in very different ways at the same time. So there's a potential, there's always a potential for telling a new story.
So technology can be good and bad.
Yes.
Changes can be good and bad.
I can't believe you just burst my balloon here.
As someone
who actually also does historical research, people have been saying that for more than 100 years.
Are you saying that we're not living in unique times?
We are not living in unique times.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. But no, I think through this conversation, I definitely have a very good understanding of the course. And I think it would be really fascinating to think about students treating it like an opportunity to kind of step back and think how they tell their story, how they listen to other people's stories, and how in the future they can play a positive role in telling, once again, their story and other people's stories.
Right.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carolyn Kitch.
Thank
for
you
our conversation.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to meeting the many students who are going to take this class.
Thank you again. It's fascinating to think about what we know about the past. What we think is ironclad history is more or less a collection of images or stories that have been told and retold and accepted writ large until we think it's the whole unimpeachable truth. And with that as a starting point, you know, imagine what you can do to actively improve the present and future's understanding of our time by wielding media, both traditional and new, to tell a more accurate, comprehensive story. Okay, that's it for me. Thanks for listening. We got more courses to come on Of Course.